Yeah, first point I'd like to make is that there was no prima facie case made.
Could you speak just a wee bit?
I'm sorry,
louder.
Your Honor. The first part really goes to the elements. The government didn't show all of the elements. They didn't specifically address or didn't show subject to a court order, because that term hasn't been defined.
But there was a court order of protection against Mr. Westcott, and the federal court in a prosecution under 922 is not the place where you would make a collateral attack on that order. Certainly a facially valid court order of protection issued in a domestic relations context.
Your Honor, there are two orders here. There's an initial order and then there's a second order. And at what an amended order, and at what point is he subject to the order? Once there's an order, it doesn't matter. Does it matter whether the initial order is valid, as I argue? Does it matter whether
I don't see how
one?
You can argue about its validity, frankly. It's a facially valid order. And at one point in your brief, you seem to suggest that in all of these cases, we have to call the state judge who issued the order to testify, yes, I really meant to issue that order. And that seems to me an impossible rule. This is it's an order from the state court.
The attorney for Mrs. Westcott was actually the one who filled out this order of protection and orders
but
the, but protection
this
is
how
forms.
It's always done in state court.
And then the forms weren't filled out, or circles weren't filled out correctly.
Tell me this. Was there some strategic reason that Mr. Westcott would not stipulate that the guns were manufactured outside of Illinois?
His attorney said that there was some disagreement that he had with Mr. Westcott, and he didn't feel that he could stipulate. I know nothing about it, whether they even conferred on that point.
Oh, because of course if he had simply stipulated, he could have prevented the government from producing some of these rather wildly frightening photographs.
Right, he prevented the photographs, prevented the allegations that the weapons were from out of the country, not just out of state. A lot of the prejudicial evidences wouldn't have come in. That seemed to be clearly the best strategy.
That's the kind of prejudicial evidence that's just prejudicial because it helps prove the crime. I mean, some things have moved in interstate commerce and other things have moved in foreign commerce, and if the weapon originated outside of the country, that's the fact. I mean, the government's entitled to prove that.
If you start with the premise that it's not clear what all of the elements of the crime are, and the
what's
jury,
unclear about 922G8? I just don't follow
the,
that.
The question is, what's unclear is what is he subject to?
There's a court order that's in this record telling him not to do all sorts of things. It's a standard order issued by the Circuit Court of in this case, Ogle County. There are very similar orders come out of Cook County everywhere else.
But
order
Your Honor,
of protection. The respondent is ordered to stay away from petitioner.
Your Honor, on a second order, an amended order was issued by the same judge. And the question is, does that order take precedence?
Does it matter?
Yeah, I didn't see why that mattered at all.
Why would it matter? I mean, my God, now you have two orders.
But then you have the question, is it part of personal property? Has it become part of personal property?
Let me ask you this. You didn't attempt to distinguish United States versus Lee, our Seventh Circuit case, which rejected your constitutional argument. I mean, did you concede that that case is controlling? I wondered if maybe you were just trying to preserve the issue for the Supreme Court. Is that what you're doing?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court, obviously they have final say on the matter and indicated that they believe that interstate commerce, interstate versus intrastate, that may be something that they have to be the ones that address when they're talking about discussing interstate commerce, fighting with Congress about determining whether finding of interstate commerce is really enough. Because clearly there's a finding of interstate commerce, but was there really interstate commerce here? Or was it intrastate commerce, which has been a finding in other cases?
Well, thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you.
I'm going to reserve the rest of your time.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you,
Mr. Kamen. Lamar?
May it please the Court, Michael Schmeller on behalf of the United States. The government did prove all the elements necessary under G8, including whether or not the appellant was subject to the state court order. We know he was subject to the state court order because it was issued against him. He was served with a copy of it in court. In addition, the government presented live testimony from a witness who identified the appellant in court as being there, as contesting the hearing, receiving notice of that hearing. In addition, all the content and procedural requirements identified in G8 were satisfied in this. And at trial, or on appeal, knowledge and possession of the firearms, in addition with the interstate commerce aspect of G8, were not being contested on appeal, and those were satisfied. And one of the ways that the interstate commerce aspect was satisfied was through the testimony of an expert witness who did identify some of the weapons as being manufactured outside of the United States, some of those locations, Russia, China, and Bulgaria. And those were necessary to prove G8 and all the elements of G8. Specifically, the element that was lacking in 922Q, the school zone case, which was at issue in Lopez.
Now, did you really have to introduce all of these pictures of mountains and mountains of ammunition?
We didn't. And the fact that we didn't introduce all the photos, some of the photos were held back. The photos that were introduced were consistent with the district court's ruling in the motion in limine to show that ammunition was at the house. And the type of ammunition that was the house.
You know what I found kind of interesting? The pictures seem to convey to me more about the amount of ammunition than the type. For example, if you take a look at 31G, it just shows a box full of bullets, but the type is not at all evident. In 31J, the type of ammunition is readable on only two of the many boxes. Photo 31O is even worse. Most of the boxes are not readable, but it's clear that there's an enormous amount of ammunition. I mean, pictures like this just dirty them up, don't they?
I don't believe so. It's not the purpose of what these photos were used for. The photos serve two purposes in this case. It showed the search scene. And it was the photos were also used during the live testimony. The photos were presented to the agent that testified about the search, and he identified, based on the photos, the room that was searched, and in each case, the type of ammunition that was recovered from that room.
Well, why not just have the officers testify that they found ammunition that fit the guns in question? Why, you know?
Well, I think it also did serve the other purpose of allowing the jury to observe the actual search scene and where the remaining weapons and ammunition were found.
Why did the jury need to see the search scene in Technicolor?
Well, it did go to the knowledge that the defendant possessed the weapons that were recovered in his trunk. He was not stipulating to possession of the weapons in the trunk. The government presented the evidence that all the ammunition at the house contained in each room, matching the firearms that were recovered in the trunk, would be something that the defendant or the appellant could not ignore. And the fact that all the ammunition at the house matched the weapons recovered in the trunk made it more likely that he knowingly possessed the weapons in the trunk. And in addition, during closing arguments, the government specifically told the jury this was the purpose of presenting those photos. This is why we presented the type of ammunition that was recovered for this specific purpose and only that purpose.
By then, the jury was frightened. I'm sure it didn't.
Finally, going back to constitutionality, it was satisfied in this case. It has been well settled as the court has done so in Lee. And if there aren't any other questions, I ask that the defendant's conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Ms. Kamen?
Yes. Starting with the evidence, the so-called matching evidence that would show the knowledge. I mean, the bullets that and the were basically just routine bullets. I mean, they from that could be used in any handgun, 22 caliber, 32 caliber. I mean, they weren't special. It wasn't like, well, this is from Europe, this is from Switzerland, this is from Austria. I mean, no, they were regular. They were bullets that could go anywhere. So, I mean, clearly there wasn't going to be knowledge. It wasn't going to be shown by this ammunition. It wasn't going to be the amount. They were basically, I mean, the prosecution was dirtying up the defendant. And the question is, why were they dirtying him up if they had all this evidence and it was legitimate evidence? Why would they bother? And, well, they'd bother because there were these problems, or there are these problems. Lee isn't controlling. Lee makes a general statement about 922 and that section, and what the Supreme Court says, well, you take it as to, I mean, or it implies that you take it as individually. You're taking it as to, you know, is this intrastate? Is this economic or non-economic activity? So you're not going in a whole, you're not going a whole section at a time. You're going a subsection. You know, this is this section of statute is prohibiting a certain type of conduct. It's this section of the statute is prohibiting this kind of conduct.
But there's a jurisdictional hook in this section of the statute, which is that the weapons have to have moved in interstate or foreign commerce. Your client didn't stipulate to that, so the government shows where they were manufactured.
There, Your Honor, the that's, I guess I'm going to the not to the bringing introducing that or suggesting that the weapons are from overseas and might mount to bringing the guns in for some other reason. I'm not suggesting you might have gotten rid of that. I'm talking about the fact that there was some sort of limit as to privity, constitutionality. I mean, what is there really commerce clause? Is the commerce clause actually invoked? I mean, there is a congressional finding so that you do have, it says that, well, this applies to not the whole 922, but as I recall in Lee, that only went to felons. And so that was, I mean, it says 922, but it's just for felons. So then the question is, well, I mean, felons can be anywhere in this in this state. They can't just be in a, they can move from state to state, but a school stays in one place.
We're not talking about a school. I mean, we're talking about a section of the statute that prohibits possession of firearms if you're under a court order of protection. And Mr. Westcott was. The government proved that. The weapons themselves moved in interstate commerce. and the government proves that his denial of possession of these things that were in his trunk isn't plausible because he's got a lot of ammunition that matches up to it. It seems to me, given the standard of review that you face, that you've got a difficult case here.
If the congressional finding that all of 922 if all of the prohibited conduct is subject to interstate commerce, then I do face a uphill battle. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kamen. Mr. Schemmler. The case is taken under advisement and the court will proceed.